Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast positioning itself as a unity candidate. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Excitingly, we have news to talk about that isn't a coronavirus. Even more excitingly, it's the result of a Labour leadership election. Nobody can quite remember when the leadership contest began. There are rumours it began sometime around the discovery of fire. In this episode, we're going to talk about the result and think about what it means for the Labour Party. A new star has broken, has it not? Surprising, but what is perhaps surprising, Steve, is the scale of his victory.
Starmer winning was the expected outcome for most people who'd been following the Labour leadership election. But as you say, what is absolutely fascinating is the extent to which he's managed to secure his victory. He was able to win on the first round of counting the votes with 56.2%. So he hit that threshold and kind of went above that and hit the necessary threshold quite substantially within the first round. So this is very much a sign that Starmer is backed heavily by a literal majority of the membership. And when you look at the kind of like the different blocks, I'm not quite sure what the official term for them is, but like whether it's the affiliates, the members or registered supporters, Starmer, you know, absolutely crushed it in all three of those sections as well, securing 53% of affiliate votes, 56% of the members' votes, and absolutely storming it with 78.64% of registered supporters as well. He's got a majority amongst every single section of the electorate. There is zero room to say that he does not have a mandate.
I think especially when one considers second preferences, so judging by both polling and anecdotal evidence, those generally who voted for Lisa and Andy would tend to put Keir Starmer second preference. So if you take that into account as well, he's probably got a good 70-odd percent, maybe even 80% support of Labour members generally, which is a massive figure.
Absolutely. And even amongst people in the party who are not necessarily as keen on Starmer, like anecdotally based on the people that I know, like whilst they're not enthused by him, they're fine with him. So they're not necessarily going to get the daggers out to stab him in the back straight away.
I think a takeaway from some of the leadership stuff so far is actually Twitter isn't the Labour Party and Twitter isn't representative of opinion in the party or opinion in the country. Because actually, if you look at the evidence of the voting that we've got, and you look at evidence of polling both the Labour members and of people in the country generally, actually Starmer is generally seen as the most popular with both Labour members and general public, and certainly also the least disliked. So there was some polling evidence I saw that only 5% of Labour members actually dislike Starmer. It's a very, 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 very small number. I think on Twitter, there's been lots of stories of people tearing up their membership cards or joining George Galloway's Workers' Party or something. Actually, that's a very, very tiny number. And it's just overblown by Twitter because that's what Twitter does.
It's the sort of thing where if we were in slightly more normal times, maybe some of the right-wing press might kind of have started running stories, kind of like highlighting that, trying to make it look like there was an immediate kind of, you know, dissension in Starmer's ranks if they were trying to like undermine him from the get-go. But given the coronavirus situation, nobody's thinking about that kind of stuff at the moment. So in some ways, those very loud but small in number individuals could have been a problem for Starmer from the get-go, but like they're not now. And them leaving actually makes his life easier because it means fewer problematic people attending meetings, fewer people who are less likely, it means fewer people who are going to oppose him in the party. My guess is most of those people probably aren't long-standing Labour members, because most long-standing Labour members or members of any political party are very aware that you win some, you lose some, and you spend most of your time with a leader that you don't necessarily want or back.
And I think it's a big mandate for Starmer personally. It's a big mandate, I think, for him personally to shape the party in the way that he would like. I mean, there's a couple of other results from yesterday bear it out as well, which we should talk about very quickly. So yeah. Angela Rayner is deputy leader, which is fantastic. She's going to be an excellent deputy. And again, I think she won on the third round. But actually, if you look at the results, you know, I think there are five candidates standing. Those five candidates on first preferences got between about 10 and 20%. Angela Rayner got 43%. So again, it's a big thumping personal mandate for her. Again, with big union backing that gives her the authority to stamp her vision on the party.
Yeah.
We should do a quick shout out to Rosina Alencar actually as well, who had an excellent campaign, went from nowhere to finish second.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Alencar seems to have had an absolute cracker of a campaign and has gone from being someone I reckon most Labour members wouldn't have been able to really name or know who she is. She was just a backbench MP. She's gone from nothing in terms of name recognition, I think, to being in a position now where she's almost certainly going to be given some kind of role within the party. She obviously lost the deputy leadership election, but she's proven herself to be very effective in a number of different ways, and I suspect that she's going to be one of the kind of figures to watch as things progress.
What, doing a deputy leadership campaign whilst also doing shifts on A&E as a doctor, just awe-inspiring, really.
Yeah.
The other election to look at is the NEC election, where the Progress and Labour First slate won, and all three seats, which I think no one was really expecting. Not to get too bogged down here with Labour chronology, because, you know, we've all got lives. But essentially, that does give Starmer a majority on the NEC to enact whatever internal changes he wants, which I think is also very interesting.
This to me was actually the biggest surprise of everything that came out yesterday. I was expecting Starmer to win. I knew it was quite possible that he'd win on the first round. So when that happened, it didn't surprise me. I was expecting Angela Rayner to win the deputy leadership election. So again, no surprise there. When the NEC results came out, I was genuinely surprised by this, because I was really expecting those to, the past few kind of like NEC kind of elections we've seen have been dominated and won by people who momentum have been backing. And that was not the case this time, which is a drastic shift in terms of how members are choosing to vote and what they're looking for in terms of who they want representing them on the NEC.
Is that the cue for us to now go on to the next section of the podcast, which is how these election results prove our politics?
Oh, obviously, yeah. Like that's what every election is. It doesn't matter whether you win or lose. This obviously proves we're right.
So since I've been active in politics, so probably since about the 2010 Labour leadership elections, the first one I probably remember as being politically active, with the exception, we should say, of the Bandasaurus Rex leadership challenge in 2016. But the other three have been reactions against something. So in 2010, the election of Ed Miliband was very much a reaction against the new Labour years and the wish of the party to try and break with that. That's also something that's sort of in play with Corbyn's victory in 2015 as well. But I think in hindsight, actually, the win of Corbyn in 2015 is very much a reaction to the caution of the Miliband years and the wish of a lot of Labour members to have a more ambitious policy agenda, especially an economic policy agenda. And that's something we're still play, I think, in Starmer's win too. But I think Starmer's win is probably also a bit of a reaction of Labour members to various things. I think, one, it's a reaction to the failure of the party to adequately deal with anti-Semitism. And Starmer was very clear about that in his speech, talked about it being a stain on the party. He apologised for it. He's already written to the Board of Deputies, which is very encouraging. I think it's also a reaction to the failure of the party to have a coherent position on Brexit over the last couple of years, and that muddled position where it just looked like we made the same mistakes on Brexit that we did under austerity and didn't really oppose it properly, didn't come up with a proper narrative of what we would do. It looked like we were just triangulating for electoral reasons. And I think that kind of feeds in as well to that election defeat in December, that I think not just Starmer's victory, but that win on the NEC for the Progress and Labour First Slate, I think is very much a reaction of members to that election defeat and how that defeat has been interpreted in certain circles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's probably at least one other kind of area where Starmer's victory is a reaction to kind of like how Corbyn ran things, is that just from a kind of a style perspective, they're both very different individuals. Corbyn, you know, is an older bloke, come out of his house, potter down the road or whatever. He looks like your grandfather. And that was part of his appeal in a lot of ways. He was very accessible in a lot of ways and kind of very charismatic in a certain kind of close up kind of way, where if you're in the room with him, you're probably going to be actually relatively impressed with him, but not necessarily in the same way as another thing.
Or if you're speaking at a rally, say,
yeah,
I think quite good at that in a way.
Starmer is in many ways a professional politician. He hasn't spent his entire career in working in directly within politics, but he's been working in roles like director of prosecutions, where he has to be political and politically savvy and politically aware because of the nature of the job. Yeah, is a much more slicker kind of like media performer, I think, than Corbyn is in a lot of ways. And I think, again, when we talk about reactions, they are, like, Corbyn and Starmer are kind of like two ends of the spectrum. And we've kind of swung from one to the other. Because, as you said, like, what Corbyn was doing, we now know, did not work. So why would we continue with that? Well, let's try something different.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because I think Starmer's pitch was as the unity candidate. And the other thing in his speech yesterday was that he did pay explicit tribute to Jeremy Corbyn, said that he was a friend and said that he'd led the party through some very difficult times. And the other thing that Starmer has said that he would do is carry on that radical policy agenda. So there were the 10 points that Starmer came up with during the leadership campaign. And those 10 things basically were the kind of things that Corbyn has been talking about as well. So it's about things like getting rid of tuition fees for university students. It's things like public ownership of utilities, all that kind of stuff. It's that agenda, I think, as well. Yeah. I mean, so you've almost got like the two groups of people who voted for Starmer. You've got the people who see it in your way, who are trying to see it as more a bit more of an explicit break from the last 4 or 5 years. But then actually, I think the bulk of the membership are in that kind of soft left position. And I mean, by the time we're recording this, we haven't seen yet who's got shadow cabinet posts. But when you look at some of the names who've been bannered about for top roles, like people like Annalise Dodds, people like Joe Stevens, they are in that left wing, almost love Corbyn, hate Brexit crowd. So like Starmer's slogan, another future is possible, it felt to me anyway like a bit of an echo of another Europe is possible, which was a left-wing sort of left-wing group Michael Chesham set up, sort of, and its tagline, you know, love Corbyn, hate Brexit. It's an interesting mix. It's not, you know, quite different to the official People's Vote campaign, which had people who were generally considered to be more on the right of the party backing it. And so it is, it feels like Starmer's victory comes from that kind of soft left place.
Absolutely. I don't necessarily disagree with that. But what I would say is that I think there's almost like two different kind of like things that are being reacted to. And you said it yourself earlier, like you've got actually just going back to Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and you know, the Blairite policy agenda, which the party as a whole is still not particularly keen on. that people are still reacting against that, and that is shown by the fact that it remains to be seen exactly what Starmer's going to do in terms of policy and things like that. But certainly his campaign was very much, no, we are holding on to this kind of radical agenda. Whilst on the other side of things, you've got that kind of like that reaction against Corbyn in terms of the management, the organisation, the communications, the style of leadership, where people have just kind of gone for looking for something a bit more professional rather than something a bit more the ad hocness seemingly that we had with Corbyn. So I think you're absolutely right. Starmer's base is probably going to be, you know, for lack of a better term, it's a very ill-defined term, but soft left, which, you know, great, that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. That's probably the place to be, actually, if you want to kind of actually maintain and hold power in the Labour Party. The issue he's got, though, is that he needs to build from that in a policy agenda, which can win people over in the wider electorate without kind of like costing in that base. So he's got two very kind of different kind of reactions which are interacting with each other, which have led to his victory, which could work problematic moving things ahead.
Yeah, well, again, it'll be interesting to see then with this big mandate he's got exactly which direction he does go in. And yeah, and just thinking about sort of why the challenge isn't how to grow Labour support, because Starmer takes the leadership at a time when, you know, Labour's just suffered its worst results since the 1930s, and at the moment 25 points down in the polls. I suppose it's trying to think about who Labour's vote is at the moment, who's voting for us, and then how we kind of build from there. There was an interesting report Europe for the Many did, which tried to look at the kind of seats that Labour lost, the kind of seats that we have held, and think about how to sort of bridge that gap. Although often the party is sort of caricatured as being now a party of the sort of middle class intelligentsia, that's not quite true, because actually you look at the most deprived constituencies in the country as a list of the 20 most deprived, yeah, and Labour hold 19 of those seats. The 20th is Peterborough, which Labour did hold in a by-election last year, then lost in December's election. And just so we're recording this in Birmingham, Birmingham Hall Green, Birmingham Ladywood include some of those constituencies. So a lot of them are quite ethnically diverse as well. And then as well as those kind of seats, we also hold quite a lot of seats which are home to more educated voters, home to more socially liberal voters. In terms of class, you could say middle class, but actually because of high housing costs, don't have a lot of disposable income. And so I think it's in terms of that coalition, I think actually Starmer's pretty well placed to keep the vote we have at the moment, I would say, if we kind of caricature a lot of that as being almost quite liberal, quite pro-rem. That's kind of Starmer's core, one would have thought. You look at the places that Labour lost in 2019, so in Birmingham, that tends to be places like Birmingham Northfield, or going further afield, places like Wolverhampton Northeast, or the Northeast, those kind of the Red Wall. Remember the Red Wall, Steve, we used to talk about? And they tend to be slightly older, generally less ethnically diverse, generally quite poor seats, but also quite low housing costs as well. And the voters that the report kind of indicates in those seats tend to be quite economically left-wing. So they actually, in terms of that Corbyn-like policy agenda we've talked about, they quite like a lot of the economics that's in that, but they tend to be more socially illiberal, or, you know, tend to hold more illiberal views or more authoritarian views, for want of a better way of putting it. And so I suppose the challenge that Starmer has is actually you can't really lead on, say, culture or anti-immigration or illiberal stances, you know, British jobs for British workers, that kind of thing, to try and win over those voters. Because what that's going to do is piss off the voters you've already got. So instead, actually, what the report says anyway, you kind of need to appeal to those with a more sort of left-wing transformative economic policy agenda. And so hopefully one of the things that Starmer can do is have that credibility and the ability with the mandate he's got to ensure that that's how we try and win back those voters rather than appeal to culture, which I just don't think would work.
Yeah, I agree that appealing to culture is not going to be a winning strategy. I think it's kind of been tried before now, and it doesn't necessarily win over the people it's trying to win over on its own anyway, and it costs you votes in the other direction. So that's a non-starter. I think you kind of hit the key, you've hit the nail on the head though when you use the word credibility, because I think that's the one thing that an awful lot of people felt when they looked at Jeremy Corbyn, was that he wasn't credible as a potential prime minister. Now, Starmer, it's got more of that much more traditional look of like of what we come to expect of a prime minister in the modern day, which is something that could be beneficial for him. But at the same time, what it might be actually that he's a bit of luck is kind of being thrown his way, in that already as part of this kind of like the reaction to the coronavirus, the government is starting to talk about trying to bring in the opposition parties, getting them more involved with things, and like to a degree it might just be briefings and things like that, though there have been some moots and discussions amongst senior conservatives, quote unquote, of like doing some kind of national government. But if you're getting Starmer involved in that on any level, something that Jeremy Corbyn hasn't been involved with at all, then immediately like the government have undermined a potential attack line of their own by saying, hey, Starmer isn't credible. Starmer is a risk to the British government, because they're giving him access. They're giving him the ability to have a say, which is something I think could be very beneficial to him in the long term.
I suppose the flip side of that is, I can't tell where it goes yet. Is it that, yes, taking part in some sort of government national unity would give Starmer and the party some credibility, or is it almost a way in which the government can try and use the opposition as a bit of a shield, in a way that Cameron used Nick Clegg as a bit of a human shield to distract from a lot of the bad stuff that the coalition did? It's then hard for Labour to effectively hold the government to account on what the government is or is not doing, if you're seen as making part of the decisions and almost you're responsible for part of the mess as well.
Yeah, I mean, largely it will depend on what that relationship is. So like, if you were to enter like a government of national unity or whatever, then yeah, that might be problematic for Labour. But unless it's something that's going that far, like I don't necessarily see how like the blame could be put onto Labour, because at any point Labour can just turn around and say, well, these were all decisions that were taken in February. We weren't in power working with you in February. You didn't invite us in until April or whenever it is that happens. So I don't necessarily think that would be a good strategy for the government.
Mm.
I do, and also it depends on how smart the opposition is able to play it. Let's say you get that invitation to form a government of national unity. Well, immediately you go in and you basically say, okay, we will agree to this, but here are our terms and conditions. You publish every bit of advice, every piece of comms around kind of like buying ventilators and why we didn't get in on the European PPE mass protection kind of like schemes and things like that. That all comes out and it gets made public. If you don't do that, we don't get involved, because you need to air out your dirty laundry as to where things are and why these things have been happening publicly, because we're not going to be your fall guy. That could work. In reality, though, the government then probably says, no, we don't want you involved on those terms. Well, at that point, Labour have a stick to beat the government with and saying they're hiding something because they won't publish their information. All we asked for was accurate information.
Mm. Lads, we're dangerously close to actually talking about the politics of this. Just something I'm still scared of doing. If you wanted to give us a little bit more money to actually maybe talk about the politics of this, and talk about more about Keir Starmer, you could go to our Patreon page, couldn't you, Steve?
You could indeed. If you head over to our Patreon, patreon.com/notenoughchampagne, you can throw us a couple of quid a month, which goes towards paying for our hosting. It goes towards, you know, for our website, running the podcast. And hopefully, as things go, we'll be able to use it to buy better equipment. And once we can actually sit in a room together to record on better mics, all of that kind of thing, it all goes to help improving the podcasting industry.
We have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed the logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And Dave Depper composed our theme tune, Pookie Good Times. Happy plotting.